Since 1936, the National Wildlife Federation has worked with hunters and anglers to pass the most important conservation laws in American history and to protect our sporting traditions. This podcast explores our history, our values, and the work we do to safeguard the fish and wildlife that fuel our passions. We are NWF Outdoors.
The NWF Outdoors Podcast is brought to you by Hunt to Eat, an inclusive hunting apparel company with a focus on community, real food, and conservation. Check out Hunt to Eat's NWF line, wild game recipes, and hunting and fishing designs at hunttoeat.com, and enter the code WILDLIFE10 to get 10% off your order.
Welcome to the NWF Outdoors Podcast. This is your host, Aaron Kindle, with my co-host, Drew Youngdyke. Today, we have a very unique podcast and a couple of special guests. We're going to be talking about illegal cannabis grows on public lands. And for that today, we have Jackie Riccio and Rich McIntyre, and they are the chief employees and experts on illegal cannabis grows and run an organization called CROP. It's the Cannabis Removal on Public Lands Project. And let's just start out with a little bit of bio for Rich after we say hello. Hi, Rich and Jackie. How are y'all doing today?
Very well. Good to see you guys.
Yeah, good morning, everyone.
Well, thanks for coming on. And so Rich is a director of the CROP Project. He's worked around the Northwest mostly, it looks like. He's worked for the American Land Conservancy during the Klamath Basin Water Wars, apparently. He served on presidential campaign staffs and ran a U.S. Senate campaign. He's an expert in this subject. This CROP itself has been covered by The Atlantic, NPR Morning Edition, the Associated Press, many others. And Rich is the leader of this organization. And then we have Jackie, and Jackie is a naturalist, basically of all types. She's been a wildlife biologist, an archaeologist, a backcountry horse packer, and a co-founder of the Cannabis for Conservation. And now she works for CROP. Jackie, what's your title with CROP again? I'm sorry.
I'm the regional field director.
Awesome. So this is a very interesting subject. I've heard about it on a few different, from a few different angles. I've heard some podcasts from some other people, some law enforcement officers dealing with this. It's really a threat to our public lands, and it's going to be an interesting dive, and we're lucky to have the two of you. So thanks for being here. And then one of the ways we always start this podcast is to talk about what we've been doing outside. This is NWF Outdoors. And so of course we love the outdoors, and we always talk about a little bit what everybody's been doing. So we'll start with you, Jackie. What have you been up to lately?
Well, actually, I was just up a mountain this weekend. I get out and I backpack as much as possible, and the California wildfires have stunted that to an extent recently. But like you said, in for my bio, I also was a backcountry horse packer, so I've got 5 horses, so I get out with them as much as I can as well.
Awesome. How about you, Ridge?
Well, let's see. I'm an avid fly fisherman, and I went steelhead fishing on Saturday, and I got 3 steelhead between 27 and 30 inches, all wild fish, floated 13 miles of the Rogue River. So it was an exceptionally beautiful day. It was one of those last warm days of autumn. The colors on the Rogue are just spectacular this time of year. Saw a lot of eagles, saw black bear. It was magical, as it usually is.
Excellent. Let's go to you, Drew. What have you been doing?
Last weekend, I was able to get out on a little lake inside one of Michigan's state recreation areas, public land. I actually got the maiden voyage of my little kind of 2-person that I use as a 1-person inflatable boat that I can pack in my backpack. So I found out I need an anchor with that because the wind just kind of blows it all over the lake. But I was fly fishing for largemouth and bluegills. Didn't catch any, had a few nibbles, and I had a largemouth take one of my favorite flies for for both of those species, a little zonker that he just broke right off. But that was the closest I got to actually catching anything, but learned a little bit about my new craft and what I need to get for it before next summer.
Excellent. Well, it's fall, obviously, so a lot of us are thinking about hunting. I've been out. I took a friend who had never hunted before and helped him harvest a cow elk last week. And now I'm working on my boy and I will be heading out this weekend. And my boy has never harvested an elk yet. So we're going to be working on him this year, this week. I'm looking forward to some wild, healthy meat. Hopefully we can make that happen. So good times outside. Let's jump in a little bit here. I think a lot of folks hear this and they're like, wow, this, you know, it's a little bit enigmatic. They're kind of like, wow, there's a big problem with this. You know, it's something you don't necessarily think is happening out there on the landscape. And obviously it's purposefully hidden. So let's just jump in a little, either Rich or Jackie, just tell us about this issue broadly and you know, what is the issue and how big is the problem?
So I'll start, Jackie, and then I'll let you jump in. So for two or three decades, there have been trespass grows on public lands. And as you mentioned, they're usually out of sight, out of mind. They have not been on the public radar screen because both of the locations that they are grown in and because of the lack of political will to actually address the problem. In California alone, there are thousands of trespass grows. Those trespass grows exist in Colorado and Washington and Oregon and a couple of other states as well. They are profoundly damaging to the environment, wildlife, fisheries, air, water, which we'll talk about a little bit more as it goes by. But the bottom line is that it's a serious problem. There are, as I mentioned, thousands of those sites. Most of them have never been restored. A lot of them have been busted. They contain toxics and poisons that continue to slaughter and kill wildlife on a landscape level and pollute public water supplies. So bottom line is it's a huge problem. It is just now starting to get addressed. And one of the principal objectives of the CROP project early on has been to raise the public understanding of that problem, explain what it is, how it is, who does it. In this case, it's mostly cartels, they're mostly cartel grows, and help explain the dangers that exist on public land around those grows. And then finally, you know, last but not least, working on policy at both the state and the federal level to address that problem and solve it.
I'll talk a little bit about the just the kind of way in which these grows are eradicated. So there's multiple steps to first of all, locating these sites. Many of them are just kind of stumbled upon or reported, but there's not enough resources to be able to map all of them at the moment. However, California is supposedly going to be doing more of that in the coming year, and we should have a more accurate number of them. Nobody knows exactly how many there are currently in California, and new sites are always being activated. And so law enforcement will first identify a site and do some reconnaissance and, you know, assess the situation. And then that's followed by an eradication, which is also known as day zero, in which the plants are chopped. They call it whack and stack. So everything's cut down and the growers are detained. And following that, it basically just becomes a site in the backlog that's awaiting what we call reclamation, which is not actually restoration. Reclamation is basically a glorified cleanup of the trash and camping materials that are at the sites. And it's not as intensive or impactful as restoration. Restoration obviously involves soil remediation, you know, replanting of native vegetation. And so really California only has the resources right now to do reclamation. And so these sites, you know, they're very toxic sites in these wilderness areas. And it's awful because there's not enough resources to actually do the restoration that's required. And secondly, many of these sites are actually located in designated wilderness areas where restoration isn't even allowed. So you have these pristine environments that are being contaminated, that some of which cannot be restored and some of which do not have the resources to be fully restored.
That was going to be my question, is what types of lands are these grown on, whether that was wilderness areas or BLM or state public lands? As far as location, are these generally near trails where hikers would stumble into them, or is it primarily backcountry where you're going to have mostly likely, for instance, backcountry hunters or somebody searching for a backcountry stream stumble into them?
Go ahead, Jackie.
Yeah, I mean, most of them are not actually on a trail. Most of them are down a ravine, up and over two hills, and in a pocket where people are not going to get to. With that being said, though, many hunters also like spots like that. And so your average hiker may not bump into them if they're staying on a designated trail, you know, in a national forest, in a wilderness area. But your hunters absolutely bump into them. I've personally been on hunting trips where we have had people bump into growers that are you know, guarding their crop. And it's a scary and intense situation when that happens. But to answer your question more fully, yes, these grows occur on pretty much any public land. Our focus specifically right now is on federal public lands, but there are some grows on state public lands. They're in mainly national forest, and designated wilderness areas are within national forests. But of course, there are some on BLM lands, and there's definitely some in national parks. We've seen that in California. We've seen that in Sequoia Kings National Park. They're becoming very emboldened. These drug trafficking organizations are very, very emboldened beginning to go into areas where more people are, such as national parks, you know, a much more visited area than, say, a designated wilderness area. And so it's definitely becoming more of a public safety issue than in previous years.
One of the things that I wanted to mention on what Jackie said is that most of the cartel growers are armed. So when a hunter stumbles across a trespass grow and he's out with a shotgun for grouse, or he's out with a 30-06 for deer or elk, he is generally looking down the working end of an AK-47. So you're outgunned. It's the same problem law enforcement faces. We have people on our advisory board who have been in gun battles with cartels at grow sites before. So Jackie is correct. It's unusual. It is unusual, but it is certainly not unheard of for just hikers and recreationalists to stumble across trespass grows, because people like to go into remote areas and see what's there. It is more frequent that it occurs with hunters and even fishermen sometimes. And that is that's a very, very scary situation. It has essentially created areas of national forest, certainly in California, that are simply no-go areas where people are encouraged not to hunt, not to fish, not to recreate. Tribes are encouraged not to go there and exercise their gathering rights. And, you know, that grates on us. And it's one of the reasons why we started this project in the first place.
Do you have an estimate of the acreage that has been taken out of public use then through those areas, whether it's recommended or the actual acreage covered by the grows?
Yeah, first of all, that's an excellent question. It's a question we get a lot. The short answer is, you know, going back to what Jackie said before, there are thousands of grow sites, but we don't know exactly how many, because there has not been extensive mapping done. That's one of the things that we've been working on funding for. And therefore it's sort of hard to extrapolate the rest of that. I mean, what we can say for sure is that I can think of half a dozen national forests in Northern California, Six Rivers, Klamath, Shasta, Trinity, where there are large sections where people are advised not to go because of existing trespass grow activities and either existing or past interactions with armed growers.
Wow. What about states? I mean, it sounds like you guys are focused a lot on the West Coast, and obviously the climate there is really advantageous for you know, growing things outside a little bit more than maybe the interior states with lots of public lands. But is this happening across the country? And talk about, you know, the national scale of this.
Sure. So, trespass grows are not unique to California, but we far and away have most of them. Probably 80 to 85% of the trespass grows in the United States are located on the national forest in the BLM lands of Colorado. I mean, as an example, we estimate that somewhere in the vicinity of 50% of all the black market cannabis that's produced in California is produced on those public lands. So that gives you a sense of the scale, right? Wow. So 2/3 of the cannabis consumed in California is still black market. Half of that's coming from public lands. That's a lot of weed. And that's a lot. And that's a lot of it. And that's a lot of acreage as well. One of the things we're working on right now is funding for the Forest Service to use a technique that they've developed to map most of the grow sites in the state. We actually used that technology to take the press into a grow site on the Shasta Trinity Forest last October that resulted in those articles on NPR and Atlantic and Associated Press that you mentioned earlier in the program.
You know, you mentioned a term there about the black market production. You're in California, Aaron's in Colorado, I'm in Michigan. I think all three states where, you know, marijuana is recreationally legal, if I'm correct, has the legalization and legalization as well of being able to grow at some level legally within some of these states. And I don't know the California regulations, but has that reduced any of these in any way? Has the legal demand or legal ability to grow reduced the demand for the black market illegal grow activities?
I'm going to let Jackie answer most of this question, but on the front end, I'll say no. Demand continues to increase. Supply continues to outstrip demand. I mean, ultimately, the only way this is going to end is when there's national legalization and everyone can either grow weed or there are dispensaries on the corners where you can go and buy it. Until then, the demand for it is extremely high and the dark market continues. Jackie, you want to finish that up?
Yeah. So COVID has not been helpful to the trespass grow issue whatsoever. People are staying home. People are consuming more cannabis. So that demand has actually increased. And also there's just a general lack of law enforcement, specifically Forest Service law enforcement out on public lands this year. So just the lack of their presence alone has resulted in the increase in activation of public land sites. And in terms of, you know, the legal market in California, I would agree with Rich. I would say that, you know, it hasn't really helped the public land grow issue much. It's hard to say, though. I mean, these numbers are very hard to ascertain. And legalization, though, for sure, has stressed the cannabis market. And so many legal growers, you know, have to continue to operate in the black market in order to stay afloat in the legal market. And some of them, because of the challenges associated with becoming licensed and the complicated process that entails, simply have decided to not participate and have kind of, they kind of have this cashing out perspective. And that includes the drug trafficking organizations or the quote unquote cartels. This is mainly an issue for drug trafficking organizations. Trespass grows are largely not operated by your local mom and pop grow or your legacy grower, you know, that's been growing for 40 years since the 60s, you know. It's mostly these larger international drug trafficking organizations that are smuggling in extremely toxic pesticides that are cultivating in excess that have no connection to the land or to the communities that we cherish in California. And it's virtually comparable to, you know, comparing, you know, ivory poaching to subsistence deer hunters. It's just a completely different part of the cannabis industry. And it's really important that we separate our cultivators, even if they're not licensed, those that are in process to be licensed and those that have done it on their private land, from these DTO growers on public lands.
One thing I wanted to do mention as an add-on to that's pretty important. I gave you the numbers on the percentage of black market cannabis being grown on public lands in California, which was somewhere around 50%. We believe that up to 80% of that is being exported to other states. So it goes back to the original question. There's not enough supply in other states. A lot of that weed's ending up on the streets of Chicago, St. Louis, Detroit. And unfortunately, the the garbage that they use, the toxics that they use, the banned pesticides, the banned herbicides that they use that slaughter wildlife are uptaken by the plant as well. So those chemicals are not only slaughtering wildlife on a landscape basis, they're also poisoning unsuspected users across the country.
Let's talk about that a little. I mean, you know, we talked about, obviously we have a lot of hunter and angler listeners, and that's our primary audience. And obviously for a hunter or an angler who's out there in the woods and running into these kind of folks, that's pretty scary and dangerous. But also, let's talk about the environmental impacts. I can imagine when you're talking about these toxic chemicals, you know, you live in California and a lot of this in the West Coast, we have salmon and steelhead streams and recovery areas. And beyond that, you know, if an elk or a deer goes and drinks out of one of these streams and ingests this stuff, what are some of the implications of that for the fish and wildlife out there?
So I tell you what, I'll do the fish part and I'll let Jackie do the terrestrial part of it. So from a fishery standpoint, it's a complete freaking disaster. These growers are tapping into high altitude streams, a lot of which are spawning and rearing streams for endangered salmon and steelhead. Not a lot of water there to begin with. The riparian areas are generally fairly small, and they are getting dewatered at a rapid rate. We estimate that over 8 billion gallons of water a year are stolen to grow illicit cannabis. And the results of that are dramatic. I think we are now firmly looking at the extinction of the California coho primarily as a function of trespass grows, because those high altitude natal streams and spawning streams that they depend upon have been dried up across the range. And of course, if they're unfortunate enough to actually show up in a stream and spawn, and there happens to be a trespass grower there, that they're going to end up on a plate, because these folks are not exactly steeped in conservation values when it comes to hunting and fishing. Those sites are filled with poached animals and skeletons and racks. But back to the fishery issue for a second. We are now firmly facing additional listings of endangered, threatened, and sensitive salmon and steelhead throughout California, and trespass grows are a primary culprit in that condition. Jackie, you want to talk terrestrial?
Yeah, and of course, too. There's other compounding factors in addition to trespass grows: climate change, habitat destruction, general disturbance. When you compound that with trespass grows, it's really a problem for both aquatic and terrestrial wildlife. As far as terrestrial wildlife, I mean, we have seen such an intense bioaccumulation of these toxicants in wildlife populations. It's not even funny. I mean, let's just talk about rodenticides for a second. So the term is second generation anticoagulant rodenticides. Okay, it's rat poison, which is mainly being used at these sites. Animals love to gnaw on young plants. You know, that's like the most nutritious part, is when they're young. They've got lots of essential elements, and animals know that. So the young plants, the beginning planting stages, are very vulnerable to herbivory. And so bait blocks of this rat poison are put out at these sites to not only poison wildlife, but to generally attract it. So there's like this death ring that happens at these trespass grows, where animals are attracted to the bait, and then those animals are attracted to the smell of dead animals and trash and food that's going on. So the second generation ARs, as they're commonly called, are extremely toxic for a number of reasons. So the first generation was warfarin. That was the first generation of rodenticides, which did the same thing, but they're not nearly as toxic as the second generation. So we saw small mammals develop a resistance to warfarin, which is why they developed the more toxic second generation rodenticides. And without getting too sciencey on it, it basically interferes with the natural cycle of blood clotting, with coagulation in wildlife. So when an animal ingests enough of this, it interrupts their vitamin K cycle, and they internally hemorrhage slowly and die, which is not only an awful way to die, but it's extremely toxic throughout the food web. So if you have a small animal, for example, that goes and eats this bait block, then you have a raptor that comes in and eats the small mammal or a fox, then those animals start to accumulate the same toxins because it can be passed through ingestion. It can also be passed through the placental barrier from mother to fetus. We've seen that in Pacific fishers to a great extent here in the range. And so it ends up being this whole bioaccumulation throughout California like we've never seen before. And so second generation ARs right now have been documented in 70% of northern spotted owls, which are a federally listed endangered species. Over 80% in Pacific fishers, which are a candidate species for the ESA. And over 92% of mountain lions now across the state in California, which are an apex predator. Okay, so everything below them, you know, has traveled up to them, is now testing positive for rodenticides. And some of that, yes, is from other agriculture using bait blocks in Southern California, but a lot of mountain lions throughout California have been poisoned directly from Trespasco rodenticides. And so that's obviously a big problem for hunters because it's supposed to be this very clean source of meat, this clean source of protein that you're harvesting from wild lands, which are being impacted by rodenticides from urban areas that are being brought in. And it's awful. And now California has actually restricted these rodenticides. So they are restricted. You have to, you know, qualified basically to use these. Of course, trespassers are not going through that process, but I believe at this point there have been two black bears that have been harvested that have tested positive for high levels of second generation ARs, which of course, if people consume, will then contaminate them as well, be toxic for them and for their families. And also, believe it or not, one mule deer buck has been tested, at least I think at this point. There might be more. But these are just the people that are getting their meat tested. This is not everybody. So there's probably a lot more of it going on. And that's really, it's really scary and it's really awful because the extent of this is just, it's so extensive. And it's really impacting people's ability to harvest healthy, sustainable wild meat. It's impacting populations and already declining populations of wildlife. And it's just, you know, really been devastating to the ecosystems in general.
For a little bit of perspective on this, one of the bad boys, carbofuran, which Jackie can talk about more if you're interested, but a half teaspoon of carbofuran will kill a 600-pound black bear dead. Murad Gabriel, who is one of the scientists who's done a lot of work on the mortalities associated with trespass grows, tells the story of finding a dead black bear next to a trespass grow, and a fly landed on it, and 10 seconds later fell off dead. That's how toxic this stuff is. That's wow. how easy it is to spread. And those growers now are weaponizing those chemicals to target law enforcement. Those chemicals, by the way, are being smuggled in from Mexico and Central America, but a lot of them, ironically, are still being made in the United States, even though they can't be used here. It's the old DDT story. You know, it's too dangerous for us, but by all means, let's ship it off to the developing world and let them use it. That's finding its way back into the forest of California, the forest of the West, and the food chain and the food that hunters and anglers are collecting on public lands.
You know, I think our listeners have often heard us talk about why, at least us individually, why NWF encourages hunters to voluntarily use non-lead ammunition because of that transfer through the food chain. You know, if we shoot a deer and the gut pile stays out there, we don't want a raptor to come there and get that. So I think our listeners will certainly understand that chain effect. What can hunters do? You mentioned that that's been found in some of the mule deer that have actually been tested. If a hunter is hunting, you know, in California in a wilderness area, and they want to get their, you know, say mule deer tested, is that a tough process to go through? Is that pretty cumbersome, or is that something that if a hunter is worried that may be the case, that they can actually get their mule deer tested?
I wouldn't say that it's cumbersome. It is a little bit expensive. But it's worth it to me. I would suggest if anyone hunting in certain national forests, you know, Mendocino, Shasta Trinity, Six Rivers, Klamath, Lassen, you know, just Tahoe National Forest, Stanislaus, you know, many of them in California. If you're hunting anywhere between, I'd say, 3,000 to 7,000 feet in elevation, I would get trumpet tested. Those are prime growing areas for people. There's a diversity of labs that do tissue sampling or that can do liver samples on your meat. And even if it costs you a little bit of money, I would highly recommend it. Of course, it's awful that hunters have to be doing this. I mean, the whole point of hunting is to acquire, you know, a sustainable meat and have that intimate connection with your meat, with your food. And that is just being tainted in California. You know, our deer population this year, it's awful. It's, you know, estimated at 458,000. It's a severely, severely depressed population of mule deer. And trespass grows aren't helping that at all. It's not helping people to feel, you know, like they can access these remote areas to go and hunt. It's a major public safety issue, and it's a major environmental issue. I mean, hunters really need to get on board and support our efforts because, you know, it's a major threat to that lifestyle and that way of life.
Heck of a lot of layers to this. As you all are talking, I'm sitting here thinking of, you know, tons more questions and ways that this affects a lot of things. But one of the things I wanted to back up with too is just how the heck did you two get engaged in this? Like, you know, I mean, it doesn't seem like somebody goes to school for this, or, you know, what gets you going on this kind of an issue? I mean, I could assume, but I'd like to hear your thoughts on that.
So about 3.5 years ago, I was poking around communities in Northern California. One of the things our nonprofit Community Governance Partnership does is establish community partnerships around large environmental problems that are not being addressed. And so I was meeting with communities in Northern California, Humboldt, Mendocino, Trinity County. And I knew about trespass grows. I knew they'd been a problem, and I'm always offended by that kind of stuff, whether it's a dried up river or what we're talking about. And I found that those communities knew about it. They were concerned about it. No one else was addressing it. And the politicians had kind of washed their hands of it. So, and the bottom line is that the vast majority of decision makers and the vast majority of the public did not know about this problem. So we saw a problem that needed to be solved. We saw no one else addressing it. You know, our staff, our partners in this, by the way, are the California Wilderness Coalition, Cal Wild. And so on our staff, we have a lot of deep experience in environmental issues, in campaigns, landscape conservation campaigns, political campaigns. And we decided to put those talents to work to try to solve this seemingly intractable problem. And a big part of that was simply public education, decision-maker education. This is what's going on, just like this. These are the effects, and what ultimately can we do about it? So now we've moved, you know, now we've moved in the direction, while we're continuing to elevate the problem, we've moved in the direction of actually developing policy and developing legislation to solve this problem once and for all, because this is not just going to go away. There are grow sites out there that were busted 5 years ago that were never reclaimed, that are now being used again. So until this is solved, until we get more Forest Service law enforcement on the ground in the national forest, until we get these sites cleaned up, until we clamp down the poisons coming into this country and the companies in this country that are producing them, this problem is not going to go away.
Yeah, and so we go back to your original question. I live in Humboldt County. So I live in kind of the cannabis mecca in California, kind of the OG county where cultivation happened. And I have always been involved in wildlife. That's what I'm formally educated in. So I was a biologist, and naturally just being in this place, those two kind of melded together. And I wanted to create some kind of a conservation program for farms to be able to participate in wildlife management and effective land management at scale regionally. And so I formed a small nonprofit called Cannabis for Conservation, and I started working with Murad Gabriel from the Integral Ecology Research Center. And we started collaborating a bit on different ways in which we could help support their efforts. And that's how I met Rich. I attended a community organizer training that the Community Governance Partnership puts on, where we teach environmentalists how to organize, how to analyze and identify power, and how to generate change for the environmental movement. I met Rich there, and we were working on the same issue. And so we decided to team up, and it's been a great collaboration so far. And so now I work for Crop, and we're both fighting the good fight for our public lands.
Jackie's coming up on her 2-year anniversary with the project.
It's terrific. I have to ask, you mentioned as well the reluctance to address it politically. Where does that reluctance come from? It seems like something, you know, affecting so many different facets of life in California, particularly on our public lands. Where is that reluctance coming from?
So, I think you put your finger on something when you said, man, there are so many layers to this and it's so complicated. It is complicated and it's hard to explain. And until Crop came along, I don't think anyone was doing a particularly good job of elevating or explaining it. So sometimes profound problems that are in the backcountry, as you guys know, tend to get ignored and tend to get swept under the carpet. So we shined a bright light on that and changed it. It is a difficult problem, and especially in Northern California, where there is a history of cannabis production, when you start talking about things like increased enforcement, you start talking about National Guard helicopters going in to help take out the materials, there's a bit of a shudder that goes through communities sometimes when they hear that stuff. So there's been both a lack of political will as a function of a lack of understanding of the problem, a little bit, I think, of the cannabis culture that's existed in California for a long time, and how are we gonna parse this? How are we going to explain this? So we've tried to boil it down into a handful of key talking points that are easy for people to understand. And the nice thing about this project is that it's a bipartisan project. It doesn't matter who you're going to vote for president. It doesn't matter whether you're a Democrat or a Republican, independent, libertarian, whatever. Nobody wants this shit going on in their national forest. They just don't. And so we've been really, really fortunate in that we have found receptive audiences in Democratic congressional offices and Republican congressional offices, in bipartisan offices at the state capitol as well. So it's one of those rare things in today's world that where something bipartisan actually is possible. And I think that's one of the reasons why it has received some of the attention that it has, is because that's a bloody rare thing nowadays.
You know, we couldn't imagine another place that would have such a detrimental effect on so many aspects of just even public life, right? If it's public lands, if it's water, if it's wildlife, if it's a human health issue with or a wildlife issue out there eating these poisons or poisoning the wildlife, that wouldn't garner some significant attention from folks and the desire to do something about it. I think that's a good segue too to start talking a little bit about what are the policy, you know, pushes that we could make. What are the things that we could be advocating for with decision makers to help address this problem?
Sure. Well, I think the first thing is, you know, write your congressmen, write your state representatives, and help educate them. Make sure that they are aware of the problem. Make sure that, you know, help explain to them how serious the situation is. We've been working in D.C. with Congressman Jared Huffman for a long time, who's been sort of leading on this issue over a number of years. On the Republican side, Doug LaMalfa, whose district includes the Lassen and Klamath National Forest, they have proposed a new piece of legislation called the Plant Act, which is likely to be introduced on the House floor right after the new Congress is seated. That act calls for $25 million a year for 5 years in a row to directly address reclamation of public grows on private of trespass grows on public lands, and also to increase Forest Service presence, law enforcement presence on those public lands. We feel pretty good about that. We think it's got a good chance of passage. There's the federal legislation. We've also been working with the Forest Service. We were able to get language into the last Forest Service appropriations directing them to come up with a plan to actually address this problem. That's never been directed in funding sources before. So directive language and appropriations directing them to do that. Their next appropriations come up in March and April. We'll be working with Congress and with our representatives to try to get appropriations through the Forest Service budget and the BLM budget to address the problem as well. Finally, last but not least, there are some state programs in California primarily related to forest health that have applications for this program. Trespass grows cause wildfires, among other things. So we have legislative vehicles that we're working on right now to try to fund the problem. And the support of your listeners is critical. So again, help educate your decision maker. CropProject.org has our website, has all that information on it. It has all the data. It has also the science papers. It has exceedingly disturbing videos that move people. You know, when you see a Pacific fisher flopping around on the ground, or you see a dead black bear next to a grow site, it affects people on a visceral level, especially if they're outdoors people. As most of your listeners are. So elevate it. Don't be afraid to talk about it. And when the legislation is going to happen, support it directly. Write letters and say, we need your vote on this legislation.
We'll be certain to provide the link to that in our show notes on this as well. One question, and if you're comfortable answering it, we've talked about the danger to hunters and anglers stumbling upon this, the danger to wildlife. Have you felt in your advocacy on this and any sense of that as well from being, you know, publicly bringing this to light?
I'll speak for myself and then I'll let Jackie speak. Yes. I think anytime you take on the bad guys, you know, you have a target on you. So, you know, we're careful to try not to give out our home addresses. When we're speaking in public, you know, I try to maintain some situational awareness about what is going on. I think that's likely to increase, not decrease, as we move closer to success on this as well. Jackie, you live in the middle of it. What do you think?
Yeah, I have definitely been uncomfortable at times, especially because it can be a complicated issue. Just living in a cannabis community, I mean, a lot of legacy growers did used to grow on public lands. Of course, they weren't using the toxicants that we're finding out there. But it's been complicated to thread the needle sometimes just for me and the work that I do. But in terms of feeling safe, as in physically safe, because of the work we do, yes. I mean, I've definitely felt uneasy at times, but this fight is totally a fight that I'm so glad to be a part of. I've always been an environmental warrior. I will continue to be. I will continue to fight for wilderness no matter what, even if it compromises my own safety. I care way too much about our natural world, about our home planet, about the wildlife that doesn't have a voice to speak for themselves and for the communities that try to live the hunting and angling and subsistence lifestyle. To give up this fight because I'm afraid. And I think that Rich would probably say the same.
When we took the press into that Trinity site last fall, we did not go in alone. We went in with heavy law enforcement presence as well to go into a site that had already been busted because there were other sites in that area. In fact, if I could tell a quick anecdotal story, I blew my Achilles out and I could not go down to the grow site. So I stayed up where the cars were parked while other folks took the reporters down. And as I was sitting in the car waiting, I heard a car come up the road, and I was actually hunkered down in my seat. I was trying to take a little nap. And as I looked in my rearview mirror, I saw a pickup truck with a guy driving down the road. Thought, that's interesting. Odd, hunting season hadn't started. There was no hunting season. I didn't think too much about it. Got out of the car, and about 30 minutes later, the same truck went by with three guys in it this time, suspiciously looking like growers with a bunch of bundles in the back of their rig. And that was near a site that had been busted. So there is physical, you know, there is physical danger in what we do. And when we're out there as much as is possible, we try to have a law enforcement presence with us just to protect us, to protect the people who are working with us, and to protect the reporters that are with us as well.
I'd like to just add on to that real quick too with, you know, I really want to give a shout out to all the people that are actively doing on the ground reclamation, the Integral Ecology Research Center, the Hayfork Watershed Center. And it's just, it's such dangerous work in terms of, you know, the toxicants as well. I mean, this stuff is no joke, like we've explained. These people that are doing these cleanups are constantly putting their physical being and their health on the line to help clean up our public lands. So I just wanted to add that.
Well, I was going to say, I can imagine that the communities there are probably darn tired of this, you know, in a lot of ways, and are really eager to deal with this. And, you know, Jack, you sent me some notes talking about how many different articles and things have been out there. We talked about this a little bit. I mean, I'm still kind of hung up on what is it that would, it seems like everybody, the communities, the legislators, everybody would want to deal with this. It's just kind of a problem all the way around, with from illegal activities to wildlife problems to, you know, to usurping those who are trying to do it the right way and get the appropriate licensing and so on. I mean, is it a just lack of awareness? I'm still grappling a little bit with what it is. It seems like it's so obvious this problem needs to be taken care of.
It's also cost. This is a very, very expensive thing to do. To reclaim a site cost about $40,000. And that's without dealing with the toxics. Jackie, do you want to pick up on that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, reclamation, like we said, it's not addressing the toxicant issue. So it's just a containment of the toxicants. So if there are toxicants on site, they are contained. Okay, so like they're barreled up, but they're left there because it costs about $10,000 to remove 1 liter of carbofuran. And sometimes there's multiple liters at sites, you know, and there's, you know, I think the closest place to even get rid of that is in Nevada. So it's just an incredibly expensive process. And to go back to your question, Aaron, too, it's just, you know, the political climate has been very challenging when it comes to increasing enforcement on cannabis, simply because trespass grows happen to be cannabis. California has very liberal cannabis policies now. And so there's definitely a reluctance to prosecute. There's a reluctance to do increased enforcement because of, you know, the issues associated with legacy grows being raided and communities really being impacted by previous enforcement. But again, there's got to be this separation. Trespass growers are not part of the cannabis culture that we know and that I personally cherish. It's so far beyond what any grower would willingly do, I think, to their land. These growers are, you know, like I said, these are the ivory poachers of the cannabis culture. This is not something that can be associated with cannabis, really. You know, and another thing, it's like, it's not about the plant, right? If you're growing basil on public lands, but you're growing it with carbofuran and you're putting out rodenticides and you're poaching wildlife, I still think you should be prosecuted. It's not about the cannabis. It's about the way in which it's going down and about the desecration of our public lands.
Wow. I mean, I guess I would say I commend the two of you for taking this on. This is a heck of an issue. And I know, you know, I've heard of it a little bit here in Colorado too. I know it's spreading out a little bit. You know, when you say things like cartels, boy, that sounds ominous. It sounds like, you know, we've got a real issue that's really hard to combat, and everybody's probably pretty scared to do a lot about it. But thank you too for, you know, being such incredible defenders of these public lands and helping with a critical issue. And, you know, I don't know if you want to say anything else, what the average citizen can do, if you have names for that legislation or any other ways that folks can look this up and get engaged, you know, before we leave here to get people a little bit more aware of this issue.
So I'd encourage them to look at the Crop Project website, again, cropproject.org. There's some links on there. As I mentioned, after the first of the year, when the new Congress is sworn in, the Plant Act will be introduced. there'll be new appropriations to address. Hopefully, there'll be new appropriations to address it in both the Forest Service and the BLM budget. So the time for your listeners to weigh in with their representatives on actions to deal with this would be right after the first of the year. Mention the Plant Act, which is being introduced by Congressman Huffman and LaMalfa. Mention Forest Service and BLM appropriations to deal with the trespass grow issue of cannabis on public lands. And make sure that they personalize it. You know, make sure your listeners have an angle on this that's very, very valuable. They're the users of those public lands. Hey, by the way, that reminds me, I need to give a shout out to Backcountry Hunters and Anglers, who are one of the supporters of our projects and endorsed it early on. So there are ways to get involved. We'll be sure to be back in touch with you, give you the names of the bills, and give you some information you can pass along to your listeners after the first of the year to actually weigh in directly.
And I would like to add too, I mean, to all you cannabis consumers out there, if you're going to consume cannabis, please purchase from a licensed dispensary, because when you don't know where it comes from, chances are it's coming from a trespass grow. Chances are it's coming from a grow that is poisoned wildlife, that is completely decimating our river systems here in Northern California. So know where your weed comes from. Really know your source. Get your medical license, grow it yourself, do whatever you got to do, but just know where it comes from, because otherwise you're contributing to the problem.
Yeah, and realize that black market weed is poisoning users as well. You know, you mentioned earlier, most growers, as Jackie was talking about, most growers care about their consumers because they want the consumers to come back. Cartels could give a rip. You know, most businesses do not willingly poison their clients. They do because they don't care.
Thank you. You know, I know a lot of keyboard conservationists. It's a pleasure to talk to two real conservationists who are putting a lot on the line to care for our public lands the way you are. And we both have a lot of friends over at BHA too. So appreciate the shout out to our friends there. Thank you very much for coming on the podcast and talking to us about this important issue. And as I mentioned, make sure listeners that you check out the show notes. We're going to have links to Crop, as well as several of the stories that they've referenced as well.
Thank you so much for having us.
You're welcome. Keep up the good work. Thanks for fighting for our wildlife. Take care, guys.
Thank you for the work you guys do.
We are NWF Outdoors.